Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Greetings, folks, and welcome to Extra Time. I'm your host for today's pod, Matt Doyle, and joining me in the co-pilot seat, back on, yet another short-term contract on loan from SoccerWise HQ, is the one and only Tommy Scoops, Tom Bogert. Tom, I just want to say, that was gorgeous pizza that you tweeted last night, and I noticed that you didn't dump a bunch of ziti in vodka sauce on it, which I'm assuming is part of your shredding for the wedding diet.
A couple things to say here. One, I hope I don't get sent off here. No question, no promises, or poor Maria is going to have to jump in goal for us. And on the pizza, I reject this notion. Like, I'm getting too much of, you're eating pizza that isn't penne vodka on it? It's just like, no, man, like, that's the curveball. That's the changeup. Plain pizza is the fastball. I've always said you judge a pizzeria based on their plain pizza. You cannot hide behind toppings. And plain pizza is the go-to. It's just people remember the penne vodka more than that.
Yeah.
I have not lost any weight. Thank you. I might have eaten the entire thing last night and was curled up in the fetal position, watching the second half of LAFC.
You got seven days left, man. You could drop at least 15 pounds if you do it right in that one. Coming up on this show, it's a recap of our big Wednesday night championship night. Crew lose a heartbreaker on penalties in the Campeones Cup. LAFC might have broken their finals curse against Sporting Kansas City. The Caps survive against Toronto, make it three straight in the Canadian Championships. We're going to answer what now for Sporting Kansas City. We're going to get coaching updates from Tom on San Jose and Atlanta, some bits on Dallas, the Galaxy, and maybe St. Louis, because I think I have a little something on that one, and a deep dive on the San Jose Earthquakes, who are in the midst of an all-time bad wooden spoon winning season, or I guess wooden spoon losing season. It's going to be a lot, but let's start with what I felt was the big game of the evening, the Campeones Cup. Columbus Crew and Club America, the two best teams in North America right now, played to a 1-1 draw after 90 minutes, and then Club America ended up winning it on penalties. I think it went 7 PKs long. A little bit of controversy on the last one, but in the end, I think a fair representation of where these two teams are and who they are. The second half was, I thought, very, very good soccer. A little bit of tired legs from the Crew. I don't think anything about this outcome was particularly unfair. I think this was a good game, and you tip the hat to Las Aguilas.
Yeah, my first takeaway on this game was it felt like a final, and that seems like a silly thing to say for a final. But I wasn't entirely sure what the Crew were going to go into this with. They've been having games every 3 or 4 days, playing through international breaks, playing shorthanded during some of those games. And it seems like there has been, like, Wilfred Nancy has tried really hard to rotate this group, particularly over the last few weeks, because Darlington Nagbe has looked a little slower. Rossi and Cucho, he's been trying to get them minutes off the field. There have been some games with full rotation, and it's a trophy, but Were they going to prioritize, we got to be right for the playoffs? Same thing with Club America. They've struggled to start the Liga MX season, and things move really, really fast in Liga MX, in which, like, who knows if the head coach's job is on the line, you know, a handful of games in after winning four trophies last year. So were they going to prioritize the weekend ahead of this? And pleasantly surprised to see both teams were absolutely all in this game. It was super fun. These are the best two teams on the continent, or at least Club America were last year. I don't know exactly what
they still are.
Without Quiñones.
But they started their season by beating Tigres in what was kind of a fake campeón de campeones, because, like, usually that's between the previous two champions. Well, Club America won both of the previous two tournaments.
They still played that game? Why?
I mean, sponsorship rights, TV revenue, gate revenue. There are multiple reasons, Tom. Most of them.
Oh, modern football, man. It's all about the off the field stuff. But yeah, so anyway, like, it felt like a final. So that was a super fun game. This is kind of the game I've been looking forward to watching between these two teams, because they've been the best in North America over the last 12 to 16 months or whatever you want to say. So the Crew played like the Crew. They were struggling a little bit early in terms of getting hold of the ball, in terms of playing out of Club America's press, but they were limiting chances, really. Like, there was a few moments where Alejandro Zendejas got into a dangerous spot and didn't do a ton with it, or Brian Rodriguez would do his LAFC Brian Rodriguez impression where he'll beat two players, he'll look like the best player on the field, and then two touches later, kind of scuff a shot, or, you know, he takes a beautiful first touch around a defender, and instead of from 6 yards out shooting with his left foot, he tries a trivello with his outside, his right, puts it wide, right? Like, so it was a super fun game, and it was a great test for the Columbus Crew.
It was. And I want to give credit to Club America, because this isn't an ordinary Liga MX champion, this group. They are, yeah, as you said, Quiñones is gone, and that is a big loss, but they replace him with Diorosan, who has been very good for them so far in the Apertura. They have gone out, they brought in Jesus Davila, who obviously played a big role in the outcome of this game. They spent to reinforce a squad that are by Campeones. No one has won three in a row in Mexico in 40 years. The last time it was done, they didn't even do the short tournament setting. It was, you know, just a typical 30-35 game season, whatever it was back in the 80s. So Club America are on track to, or are aiming to do something unprecedented. And this game for them, given what Columbus have been in continental play over the past 16 months, this was a really good litmus test. And you could tell that they were super into it. As you said, it felt like a final. Tactically, it felt like something very high level, starting with the fact that Club America came out in a 3-4-2-1. They actually mirrored the Crew's formation, and that's not what they usually play under the coach Andre Jardine. They play more of a 4-2-3-1. That's kind of their default setting. Now, they have noodled around with other formations over the past month. They played a 3-5-2 in a big win at Chivas a few weeks ago, and that kind of started them getting right a little bit. But I think that threw the Crew off, and I think because of that, as you said, they had some struggles playing through Club America's press. The first 30 minutes, they weren't sharp at all, but then they started to grow in the game the final 10 minutes and what of the first half. And what struck me about that was how much it felt like a CONCACAF Champions League game, because it was like, oh, the Crew just had three great chances and they didn't score a goal. And when you leave the door open like that, we are trained to understand what comes next. And so when Davila gets on the field and he scores that goal and it's 1-0, we've all seen this movie before. This ends 3-0 to Club America. And I think it's a measure of how good the Crew are that they didn't take their foot off the gas. They didn't panic. They didn't panic at all. And it ended up being like that second half, Tom. I thought that was some special soccer.
That was absolutely excellent. Yeah, this Crew team does not know another way to play. It is beautiful. I love watching the way they play. I love that they don't get flustered often. Like, it's always weird to see, again, Club America, a historic team in Liga MX right now, a ton of quality on the field, a ton of quality they brought in off the bench, by the way. Like, the backup, air quote, like, attacking trio that came in was phenomenal. But, like, it feels weird even when a team of this magnitude is putting the Crew under so much pressure that, like, Darlington Nagbe looks a little bit flustered in, like, as he's getting pressed, or Sean Zawatski is struggling a little bit with his positioning, or, you know, trying to run off, you know, getting elbowed in the ribs, or that kind of that collision that he had. It always feels a little weird, and I think that's a testament to how incredible the Crew are and how dedicated and forthright they are to the way that they play. In the second half, and again, as you said, the last, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of the first half, they really grew into the game. My favorite part of this is Cucho Hernandez, once again, a really good performance in a big game. That's all he does. And I'm trying to not take it for granted, even though I don't have anything to add on that, because it's just routine now for him.
The potential Trivella assist to Diego Rossi. I was like, oh, he saw Lamine Yamal do that last week. He's like, oh, I could do that.
But my favorite part about this is that, bro, he played like a 10. That was not a 9.5. That was not a, oh, he's just drifting into pockets when it makes, like, bro, he played like a 10. And he played like he, like, if he played as a traditional number 10 in a different system, would he still be one of the best players in the league? It looks like it. If he played as a traditional number 9 or like a channel running number 9, like he kind of did under Caleb Porter when he first got here, he would be one of the best in the league at that. It's like, this dude is such a complete player.
Or just a pure, how about a pure left winger, right? Like a goal scoring left winger. Yeah.
Inside forward. Like, he's just, and his intelligence of knowing when, and like, Christian Ramirez too, I think, is excellent at this, at filling in the space. The way that those three interact, which ends up with on that Trivella cross to Diego Rossi, like Rossi at 5'8" or whatever he is kind of snapping a really good header off. And like that movement comes from Christian Ramirez vacating the space and Cucho playing as a 10 rather than a forward, right? Like, so this team, they have answers for every different question. And it's about when they figure it out, not if. And Taylor Twellman said it on the broadcast that I thought was a really good point of, like, Nancy talks to Darlington Nagbe, and then Nagbe talks to the team. I love that. Like, he's like a coach on the field, and like there was a break in play because of either an injury or a foul or whatever. Nancy said something to Nagbe. Nagbe relays it to the team. And the next 15 minutes, the Crew are the better team in the game, right? Like, it was a back-and-forth game, but right off that moment and the way that they make those in-game adjustments, it's nothing that I've really seen in recent MLS. Like, there have been some wonderful, wonderful teams. I haven't really seen something like this where they can be super amorphous and they can grow and change with the game, and they most of the time make the right decision.
I think one of the things that we have seen, like, the only chink in the armor at this point is that reliance on Nagbe. Not so much in the coach on the field way, like that's what veterans are for, especially veteran center midfielders. But Nagbe has looked slow over the past few weeks. He's played a lot of minutes this year. He's played about 3,000 minutes this year. It's felt like it was catching up to him, and he wasn't bad last night. It's not like he was you know, dead weight out there or anything. And same with Zawadzki, who I think was struggling a little bit after he took that elbow in the ribs, like right at the start of the game. But neither guys were impactful or effective at moving the game to the places where the Crew usually open the game up. I thought they were playing a little bit slow on the ball and a little bit careful. And then defensively, look, Nagbe and Rudy Camacho was the other one. They were both a step slow. And that is where I think the sheer volume of games that they've played this year and the weight of all those minutes, those mid-30s legs are carrying. And I just, you know, Weeby and I have been talking about it on the show for the past few weeks. It's like, I just wish they had been able to find 400 or 500 more minutes of rest for those two guys. And I think that if they had, I honestly don't think the Davila goal happens. Because if you look at it in that moment where the Crew lose the ball, the challenges come in, but they're a step or two too late. And I think that's just like, 6,000 minutes combined from your most important central midfielder and arguably your most important center back.
Yeah, I'm sure that plays a role. And we won't know the answer to this question for sure in terms of exactly what percentage points that plays. But like, part of it for me is you look at Club America again, like we're talking about how great they've been. Like, is it possible that Rudy Camacho just looked a little slower against a $10 million forward rather than, you know, whatever the last teams that they've played? I'm struggling on their last schedule. But
I
like,
don't know, man.
I think it's part of the quality.
Rudy Camacho was fine against Luis Suarez. I don't think he was shook by Henry Martin.
Think Luis Suarez was running behind him and making him look slow?
I mean, Henry Martin has got Matt Doyle speed. I don't think that was the issue.
Get Matt Doyle beard, too.
That's true. That's true. Let's talk about it overall. So over the past month, since League's Cup, the conversation has been on. Like, are the Crew the best team in MLS history? They won MLS Cup in style last year and beat some excellent teams along the way. Like, that Cincinnati team they beat in the East Final was really, really good. And then beating LAFC the way they did in that final, high level, and then spinning it into a fantastic run to CONCACAF Champions Cup final, and then winning League's Cup in the way they did. We have talked about this as the best MLS team of all time. I still think they are. But part of that was, okay, you have to beat Club America in this game. Then you have two trophies. We're not going to put you in the conversation, probably, if you only have one trophy. It's just not applicable in the same way that 98 DC United or 2017 Toronto FC. So does this put more pressure on the Crew down the stretch to maybe sneak back into the Shield race, and more pressure for them to defend their MLS Cup title?
I mean, there's definitely pressure on this team to continue performing, to continue winning trophies and pushing for trophies. So there's that on one hand. On the other hand, it's like, it depends on what the conversation is. Is this just about the 2024 Crew, or about this era of the Crew, the Wilfred Nancy, Cucho Hernandez, Diego Rossi?
I think it's more of that. I think it's more the second one.
Yeah, so if it's that, like, they do have the two trophies, and they do have the finalists of the CONCACAF Champions Cup, which all goes into this resume. And I don't think that you can call them, like, I guess best versus most successful. And we're really parsing words here. This is a classic sports radio discussion. But if you want to call them, like, say, the most successful team kind of in this era, they have to win MLS Cup. They have to. Or they can't, I don't think, fairly be called, say, the most successful team. In terms of best, like, losing in penalties at Club America, and then let's say they get to MLS Cup or the Eastern Conference Final and lose in extra time to Cincy or Miami or whatever, right? Like, they're not any worse than they were if they would squeak by in one of those games, right? Like, so if we're talking most successful, it has to be trophies. There is less nuance. It is more about bottom line results. If we're talking about, you know, best, right? Like, it's, this team is one of the best that I've seen, and I don't know what they would have to do down the stretch. Would it have to be a shocking first round exit for me to question that? Like, I think that they're kind of ensconced there.
Okay.
As in the conversation. Sorry, making sure that I'm not saying that ensconced is absolutely the best, no need to talk about it anymore. But like, this group, this 23-24 Crew, this is going down in MLS lore, 100%.
Yeah, but I guess the question is, does it go down in MLS lore in the way that Toronto's 2017 or, you know, the Bruce Arena's Great Galaxy and DC United sides, or does it go down in MLS lore in the same way as that great RSL team with Kyle Beckerman and Javi Morales and, you know, that Jaimison Olave? Everybody loved that team. Everybody recognized that team as probably the best in MLS over a four-year span from 2009 to 2012. Well, second best, I guess, because the Galaxy were pretty hot around then. But, like, they just kept coming up short, and in the end, they only won one trophy. Yep. Now, Columbus are already on two trophies. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't know. I kind of feel like for them to cement themselves in that group, like, the argument for Columbus is, yeah, when it came time to actually win the thing, they won the thing. Mm-hmm. And if you look at their record against Liga MX sides, like, they beat Liga MX sides in a way that nobody in MLS history has beaten Liga MX sides.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that as of right now, again, without another cup or another shield, and again, I think, I'm not ready to say Miami is doing anything but winning the Shield, so I don't even want to have that conversation. For me, like, they're in that group with that 2019 LAFC team, that Carlos Vela, the best individual season in MLS history. Dude, I was looking at this morning. That team scored 85 goals in 34 regular season games. They had a plus 48 goal difference. Like, we kind of gloss over that a little bit because they own, air quote, only won the Shield, right? Like, this Crew team, like that, like LAFC, like, that was one of the best teams I ever saw in MLS. So, like, they're all in this conversation. But again, if you want to be some of the most successful teams, another trophy.
Yeah. They have two more chances at it this year. They have the Sporter Shield, which I'm with you, Tom. I don't think that Miami are going to give up this lead. Maybe they don't set the single season points record. Columbus will have a say in that. If Columbus beat Miami in, was it 2 weeks, then Miami can't set the single season points record. Mm-hmm. So they still have a part to play. But it really does come down to MLS Cup. And if they win MLS Cup, they'll have gone through, most likely, both Cincinnati and Miami in the Eastern Conference, and then getting somebody out of the West, perhaps even the U.S. Open Cup champions, LAFC. That's our segue. We're segueing to the U.S. Open Cup. 3-1 LAFC after extra time. It is their first win in a final since the 2022 MLS Cup final. They had lost four straight. It is their first outright win in a final, because remember, 2022 MLS Cup, they had to take that to penalties after some Gareth Bale heroics. Is the curse broken? That's it. That's the first question right here. They beat Sporting Kansas City at home. They hoisted a trophy. Is the curse broken for LAFC? And I guess more to the point, was there any curse in the first place?
That's where I was going. I reject the premise. Like, there wasn't we just spent 20 minutes or whatever it was waxing about this Columbus Crew team. And we've done that on our shows, on Extra Time, on SoccerWise. It's been on MLS Season Pass. There have been so much love for the Columbus Crew, rightfully so. You can't call it a curse if LAFC loses on the road at Columbus in two finals over a year when we're talking about, is Columbus the best team in MLS history, right? Like, I don't call that a curse. If they lost at home to Kansas City, that would be a much different story. But they didn't. The better team won last night.
Yeah, I think I agree with that second part. I mean, the first part of the curse is like they weren't just losing to LAFC. They got smoked by Club Leon. They became the first MLS team ever to make it to CONCACAF Champions League final and lose both legs. That was bad. And they lost in Campeones Cup.
Okay. Well, that was bad? They got to the CONCACAF Champions Cup final. Like, the Seattle Sounders a few years ago were the first MLS team to win this in this iteration. We were running we were giving a Toronto a victory lap for going to penalties in the final for CONCACAF Champions League at the time.
Yeah, I think if we talk, if LAFC had performed anything like that, anything up to their level, then we wouldn't be talking about them and their failures in finals. We would be saying like, oh, bad luck. We would be talking about that in the same way that we talked about the Crew just now. Tom, they lost both legs in CONCACAF Champions Cup final last year. The first MLS team ever to do that. Then they played in Campeones Cup. They played against the ball, and they were lucky to take it to penalties where they lost in penalties. They got smoked by the Crew in MLS Cup. They got smoked by the Crew in Leagues Cup. That is a bad record in finals. That is why we have to have the conversation, was there a curse?
Would it have been better if they lost to the Philadelphia Union in the semifinals of that CONCACAF Champions Cup tournament? Because we wouldn't be talking about this incredible stat of they lost both legs in a final. Who cares, dude? They lost the final. Like, whether they lost two legs or one leg, who cares? Like, we wouldn't be talking about this if they lost in a semifinal. We're not talking about the Philadelphia Union when they lose in the semifinal of the CONCACAF Champions Cup. Like,
we do. Absolutely do. We talk about the Union and say, oh, man, they don't have enough talent to win the big games against the best teams. The front office and ownership get criticized for that, for not furnishing the Jim Curtin with those types of players. It should be mentioned that LAFC have traditionally gone into finals the last year and a half without their full complement of DPs. They never had three DPs last year. They did not have three DPs, in the leagues. Well, I guess they added Giroud before the Leagues Cup, so they did have him, but he wasn't fully up to speed. And in this one, who scores the goal to get it going for LAFC? It's Olivier Giroud.
He scored in the Leagues Cup final, too, in case you forgot.
Fair. But that game was
I don't look at it as a negative if you get to finals and lose. Like, we're going to go Super Sports Radio, LeBron versus Jordan, all this stuff. It's like, oh, like LeBron lost in the finals. It's like, would it be better if he lost in the first round? Like, I don't see it as a negative to lose a final. Like,
no,
yeah, it's disappointing. You want the trophies.
That doesn't mean you don't talk about why keep losing finals and say, hey, they keep losing finals for reasons X, Y, and Z, and that is bad, and that
they
is
won last night. They won last night.
There we go.
Okay. And we're spending 15 minutes talking about what if they lost.
I think we're talking about what were the preconditions to even have this discussion in the first place.
I don't know. I just wanted to
make
you angry.
As you said, they won last night. So I guess the curse is broken. The curse that Tom does not think exists in the first place. I understand. The Knicks don't even make finals, so you don't get it. But trust me.
Dude, we had a trophy parade for winning not the first round, for winning one game in the first round against Trae Young a few years ago. So every little bit of success, I'm grabbing with two arms and not letting go.
Well, LAFC had a lot of success last night. Olivier Giroud, as mentioned, scored the first goal in this one. And credit to Sporting Kansas City for fighting back and answering almost immediately and pushing it into extra time. And once they got to extra time, the sheer weight of LAFC's talent, I think, shone through. And it ended up being 3-1. Which was, I think, a fairly accurate representation of how the game played out. Kai Kamara, you know, got the iced it, the cherry on top with his late headed goal, which is a classic Kai Kamara goal. What did you see from LAFC? And do we think that they are back now after this bad little run they had heading into this game?
Yeah, I think on all fronts, I thought it was a very good performance. Not great, but a very good one. Definitely a positive one. I thought Giroud was more involved than he had been previously. Specifically looking at a few moments of Danny Bowanga getting to the end line, cutting it back for Giroud. One was a goal. One was a nice save by Melia.
Yep.
Seeing those moments is hugely important because I kind of thought that was going to be a seamless transition. You put Giroud in this team, not just how great he is, not just how intelligent he is, but the way that he kind of was going to complete this attack. He could be the guy who does the false nine stuff like Matty Bogosz. He could be the guy that does the proper number nine stuff like Kai Kamara and a little bit else of other stuff to be a complete forward that was supposed to unlock this team from, hey, I know that we want to defend deep and counter and kill you with Bouanga in transition. Well, now we're also going to play some beautiful football with Olivier Giroud at center forward and kind of combining. We did not see that over the last month. And in fact, it got a little bit worse in terms of results, in terms of everything else. Seeing this performance, I thought was very important. And for me, it's always going to be in the near term, what this team looks like with Giroud. Because again, I think that they need him to take the next step to be a more serious kind of threat for MLS Cup coming down the stretch here. And like
a team that
this was
break
a really positive
curse.
Performance.
A team that could break their finals curse.
Yeah, the team that won the 22 MLS Cup breaking the curse.
We should mention that it was back to the, you know, 5-2-3. It was back to
I didn't love that.
Yeah. I don't either. I mean, our good buddy Sasha Kleshtin thinks that is the best formation for LAFC, and formations aren't tactics, but they do right. Sort of inform tactics. And when they play with the five, they drop their line a little bit deeper. They're very good about sort of routing opponents into, you know, sort of the wide channels and creating turnovers there that then facilitates their counterattack through the wings.
That was best pre-Giroud for me. That's why yes. I was disappointed to see that starting in a final where Giroud is getting closer to 90 minutes fit and getting closer to having more reps with this team. So when they, and again, with Mario out injured, it's like, oh, this is an easy spot to go back to the 4-3-3 and try to play a little bit more expansive. You're at home against a team that you are significant favorites over. Sporting Kansas City to win in 90 minutes was 5-1. That's not an even final, right? Like, so I was disappointed when I saw the team sheet because, like you said, the formation doesn't equal the game model. But with LAFC, when they play five at the back, they're trying to hit you in transition mostly.
Yeah, and they did on that first goal. Was it Rindov won the ball and started carrying it off the back line like he thought he was, you know, Franz Beckenbauer. That didn't work out so great for them. Midfield turnover, you know, nice ball in, you know, through from the channel into the flank for the pullback for Giroud's goal. And the second goal came down the left flank. Campos did some really... Go ahead.
Backup left back on his weak foot, and he's doing that in a final. Like, when we talk about the brute force talent million, with this team.
Yeah, $5 million left back is what that one was right
there.
It's incredible. I still don't know that I agree that this is LAFC's best look. I think back to the way they played the first 4 months of the season, right up until they took that 5-1 against the Crew. They played out of a 4-3-3. They were up usually over 50% possession. Their passes per sequence, I've looked at all this data on, you know, the various data collection tools that we have, and like their passes per sequence were higher. Their field tilt was higher, which meant they were actually playing with the ball more in the attacking third than the other team. was doing. All of that stuff has kind of gone away. They are back to being something close to what they were down the stretch last year, which is still a really good team. As you said, brute force, $5 million left back coming in to win a final. Nobody else in the league has depth of talent like that. But also, we saw what happens when they play like that against the Columbus Crew. We've seen what they've lost 4 out of 5 to the Houston Dynamo. Now, granted, the only one they won was in last year's MLS Cup playoffs, but still, the Dynamo are a Western Conference version of the Crew. And, you know, this one, they were the better team. They weren't great. And Sporting Kansas City got a lot of the ball in a lot of good spots. And just like Alan Pulido is not making it happen at this stage in his career. And I thought they left some moments on the table. And it, you know, anytime you win a trophy, it's good. But I didn't walk away from this thinking that LAFC are inevitable in the way that in the past we have felt like LAFC are inevitable.
Absolutely. Like, you kind of go back to the highlights. Johnny Russell had a 1v1 with a fullback in stoppage time when it was 1-1 before it went to extra time, and he got a shot off. And how many times have we seen that highlight where the ball hits the back of the net?
Yeah.
Like, these are the fine margins, and for me, it shouldn't have come down to that. Like you said, like, I started this by saying the better team won. I think good, not great, because I think you need to eliminate that moment. I think it needed to be 3-1 or 2-0. Then it should have been the way that the extra time ended in the last 5 minutes, where it was just like kind of running out the clock. We're up 2 goals. Like, it's over. Like, let's start the celebration. That should have been at full time. And again, like, they came that close to a special moment from Johnny Russell. And in this league, in the playoffs, there are going to be several special players on the field at any given time that can have a moment like that, that can, you know, a game that you should win that you end up losing because you don't completely dominate and don't completely take control.
Speaking of Johnny Russell, this could be his swan song with Sporting Kansas City. He is out of contract at the end of the year. So is Tim Melia, who was, I thought, excellent in this game. Yeah. Remy Walter, who came on for the second half of stoppage time, or extra time, I should say. Andre Fontas, who did not play in this game. Eric Tomey, they have a player option on him. He's at, I think, $1.1 million. There are a lot of guys who have been around for a long time who are not guaranteed to come back. And this ended the competitive portion of Sporting Kansas City season, right? This was it. The rest of it from here on out, they've already been eliminated from the playoffs. The rest of it from here on out is just sort of playing out the string and maybe trying to be spoilers. What do we expect from Sporting Kansas City? Well, I wrote my piece. I know what I expect. It's rebuilding time for this team. They said before the summer window, it was going to be a 3-window rebuild. Then they did almost nothing in the summer, but they could pretty easily open up $5.5 million worth of salary budget to work with and 2 DP slots. If there is a time to go hard and do all of the above, yeah, I think the time is now. The time is upon us for Sporting Kansas City.
Time was upon us a year ago. Time was upon us a year and a half ago. Time was upon us 2 years ago. What about Sporting Kansas City in MLS 3.0, 4.0, whatever version you want to call it? What about their history suggests to you that they're going to go out and fill DP spots with 2 real DPs? Because I think part of the Alan Pulido extension, which is not looking great, I think part of that was, hey, he's better than nothing. He's better than rolling the dice that we're not going to get any money from ownership to go out and bring in a real replacement. So we already have the DP here. We already spent X amount of millions of dollars to bring him in. He just had his best season with us in a contract year, his most healthy season. Let's bring him back. I don't trust this group to completely overhaul what they've got. I don't trust this group to completely stay with the trends in modern MLS.
To put this into context, from 2010 to 2021, here is Sporting KC's finish in the conference every single year. Third, first, second, fifth, sixth, fifth, first, 11th, first, third. One bad year in, what is that, 12? Mm. Since then, 12th, 8th, and what are they now in the Western Conference? I think they're 12th or 12th. 13th.
They're 12th. And yeah. They have St. Louis is tied on points with them. St. Louis has a game in hand. So
yeah. So 12th or 13th. Yeah. That is the latest iteration of MLS. That is where they have struggled. And like they made that great charge last year into the playoffs and they won that series against St. Louis that maybe covered over some blemishes. But it turned out to be a little bit of fool's gold and they can't make the same mistake this year. They can't say, oh, we made a run to the US Open Cup final and we played pretty well in it. So let's stand pat. Like they need to go out and make the kind of moves that ownership has talked about. Ownership has talked about, spending in these transfer windows. And that doesn't necessarily have to spend $15 million, right. Atlanta United style, but like you better be ready to spend 10 on two players. You know, you better be ready to make painful decisions about, maybe Nemanja Radoja, whose contract is guaranteed next year. Maybe we find a way to get out of that deal because the flexibility is worth it for us. And then the onus is on Peter Vermees, not only the GM, Peter Vermees, because even though Mike Burns is there, it's still Peter Vermees running the ship. It's on Peter Vermees, the coach. And that is, look, I have some level of worry about that because the team has not been able to consistently play their style of soccer in a winning fashion over the past 3 years now, and honestly, four of the past five. That is not great. That is not great.
I'm more worried about the talent acquisition and the funds to do so and the
I am 80-20 more worried about the talent acquisition than the coaching. Think if they get the right number six, then that my worry about the coaching goes down significantly.
Yeah, and even with that, like we've been saying that since Ilya left. Like this is, I think that's kind of why I'm more pessimistic than optimistic because none of these problems are new. They can't defend, like the lack of mobility at center backs, particularly without Danny Rosero, and the lack of a top quality defensive midfielder since Ilya left. That's not new. They've been trying to shuffle around the attack to, hey, what happens when Johnny Russell is in his mid-30s and can't sing when he can't lead his team? What if that one outlier season from Daniel Shalhoub, what happens if that's the outlier and he's just going to score, 7 to 10 goals, which is nice, but if everything around it isn't up to top notch, then it's not enough.
And then on top of it, there is the lack of player development, and here's what I mean by that. The one guy that has really developed nicely over the past few years for Sporting Kansas City is Jake Davis. And it turned out in mid-season, Peter Vermees realized that Jake Davis needed to be in central midfield because of his skill on the ball, his ball-winning ability, his field coverage, and like he brings all the classic Sporting Kansas, like the Roger Espinoza stuff to this midfield. And he was awesome last night. But Jake Davis was essentially the only right back on the roster. And moving him to central midfield meant that you needed to make Kyrie Shelton, a 31-year-old career attacker, your right back. And guess who got a front row seat for all three goals scored by LAFC last night? And it's a little unfair. It's not, I don't think Kyrie Shelton was like solely at fault for, or even majority at fault for all of those. But he was right there, and a more experienced actual defender, I think, could have done better. Certainly on the Giroud one, he could have read that earlier and blocked that shot. And this is where this sort of cascade of failures with signings, guys like Remy Voltaire and Nemanja Radoja. Mm-hmm. The other central midfielder now is Zoran Bassong, who is not really a central midfielder. And the Campos goal, he gets, like, Zoran Bassam gets absolutely buried and just, like, pulls out of a challenge and does not want anything to do with it. And that's a game-winning goal. And so this is, look, this is why, again, I'm still more concerned about talent acquisition, but I'm also worried about player development, because that great run that Sporting Kansas City had from 2010 to 2020, most of that was built around their ability to take guys like Matt Beisler and Graham Zusick and Roger Espinoza and Kai Kamara and Dom Dwyer, guys who they got through the draft or for cheap, and turn them into all-star or above caliber players. And that has gone away. So it is a worrisome trend for Sporting Kansas City. I thought they really did themselves proud last night. They played hard. They played mostly good soccer. They don't have the type of number 10 who can win a game. Alan Pulido was miserable. I thought, like, one of the worst players on the pitch for most of it. Like, if you're carrying a DP like that, your hands are tied a little bit. So there's so much stuff that this team has to figure out going into next season. I'm not super optimistic about most of it.
No, but yeah, like that's the thing. I don't trust them to find the next Danny Bwongo or even Mikhail Ura, right? Like we don't need to,
or Johnny Russell, the next Johnny Russell.
Yeah, even probably the better example there. Like, again, we don't need to just cherry pick the best examples. Like, oh, go find Cucho, go find Danny Bwongo, right? Like, even like a middling DP, their designated players are Pulido, Redoya, and Daniel Shalvey this season. Like, just not good enough in 2024 in Major League Soccer.
This weekend for Sporting Kansas City, they are going to St. Louis for the barbecue, facing their eternal enemies of a year and a half. Both teams essentially eliminated from playoff contention. That one's at 8:30 p.m. Eastern on MLS Season Pass. LAFC, a big cross-conference matchup, maybe an MLS Cup preview as they head to Cincinnati to take on the Garys. That one's 7:30 p.m. Eastern on Saturday on Season Pass. And should have mentioned, the Crew are at DC United on Saturday as well, 7:30 p.m. On Season Pass. DC is desperate, by the way, so the Crew are going to have to bounce back from the disappointment they suffered last night, and if they want to keep any faint glimmer of the Sports Shield alive, they need the full 3 points in that one. You're laughing, Tom.
I can see 6 goals for Columbus Crew written all over this game.
Jason Russell Rowe, monster performance.
Honestly, like, I can just see a scrambling DC United defense and Cucho playing in Jason Russell Rowe or whatever, right? Like, so we'll see.
The more interesting one is Cincinnati versus LAFC.
Oh, 100%.
That is one of the games of the weekend. I'm going to be locked in on that one early on Saturday night. The final championship match of our wonderful Wednesday, Vancouver play terrible soccer, but hold on for a 0-0 draw and then beat Toronto FC in penalties to win their third straight Canadian championship. That gets them not just a trophy, but a spot in next year's CONCACAF Champions Cup, which obviously is becoming an annual thing for the Caps under Vanni Sartini. Here's what Vanni said after the game. It's a fantastic feeling. I'm really proud of the guys. I told them after the game, this is the victory of love. This is the victory of love of the guys for each other, of togetherness of this group. Everyone was really, really pulling for each other, because even in a day where TFC played better than us, we fought. I'm really happy for them. I mean, that's Vanni.
I love Vanni Sartini. So that's what he said in his post-game press conference. He did, right after the whistle, an interview with One Soccer in Canada. And it was, he said hit a lot of the same notes, pointing that, like, look, we weren't the better team. And he's probably the best coach in the league at acknowledging that and saying, that's fine. Still find a way to win, right? Like, he's really honest. I love that. But it kind of went on about the love and everything. And then they joked. It's like, hey, don't the fans want you to take off your shirt again? And he goes, oh, no, we're not doing that. And as he's talking, he goes, how about this? I take off my shoes. He takes off his shoes. He goes down like a half inch. He's just like clearly barefoot or in socks. He's like, new tradition. We'll just take off his shoes. within, well, I don't know, what felt like 10 seconds, there's pictures on Twitter of him walking around without a shirt on the field. So, like, that lasted very, very shortly. And this is why we love him. And, again, the fact that we're starting with post-game quotes and Vanni Sartini beautiful antics, the game wasn't much to write home about.
The game was terrible. It was a bad game of soccer. I think the Caps didn't have their first shot until the 85th minute.
Oh, my God. I didn't even realize it was that dire.
Yeah.
Hey, man, trophy to trophy.
It was terrible. Well done. The young goalkeeper, Isaac Bomer, he made the play of the game. He saved a Federico Bernardeschi penalty in about the 40th minute or so. Toronto were better. It was not particularly close in terms of quality on the field. For whatever reason, the Caps came out asleep, and you got to give credit to the Reds for damn near pulling it off. But it's one of those things where their lack of quality besides Bernardeschi is just kind of glaring, and Lorenzo Insigne is the biggest culprit there. He was not able to do just about anything, and it when it gets into penalties, strange stuff can happen. And we've seen Sean Johnson win big penalty shootouts in the past, none bigger than 2021 MLS Cup. This time, it was the kid in the other goal who got it done, Isaac Bomer. Do we think that Vancouver have done enough? Because they've been playing pretty well before this game. Brian White is back. Ryan Gauld is excellent. Fafa Picot has had one of his best years. I think Pedro Vite has played pretty good soccer over the past 2 or 3 months. And then the addition this summer of Stuart Armstrong. We haven't seen all of those guys on the field together yet. Armstrong came in the 85th minute, ended up missing a penalty in the shootout. But they at least went out and did something. Because we've been saying year after year after year, they need more top-end quality. Stuart Armstrong is supposed to be that top-end quality.
Yes. The team is better with Armstrong on the roster, but again, I'm curious to see how much of a difference is that enough to take them into the next kind of level. What rather than, oh, they're a playoff team and they're going to lose in round 1 to LAFC or insert whatever team, in the past, it's just been LAFC. But, I think that it was pretty glaring that they needed another addition this summer to try to push them into a new tier to challenge with some of the better teams, the topper teams in the Western Conference. I'm not sure if Armstrong is or isn't, just because we haven't seen a ton of his effect. He scored against San Jose Earthquakes off the bench because I was critical of the signing, because this deep, he cannot be bought down. He's a designated player. And I was surprised by that as a player out of contract at 32 years old in the position that he plays. And have had some Vancouver Whitecap sources have had some fun with me. I was getting texts immediately after he scored against the San Jose Earthquakes, which I appreciate. That's fair. I'd rather that than them talking about behind my back, so that's good.
I talk about spiking the ball at the 30-yard line, though. My goodness.
So, again, he might be, right? Like, and I've heard the arguments for it. Like, the way he progresses the ball is something that they feel they desperately needed. The way that he can hopefully free Ryan Gauld to be better in the attacking third and in turn, he becomes a difference maker, even more so of what they needed. And then obviously you have Brian White, who's a very good center forward, a reliable goal scorer. So if Ryan Gauld can take another half step forward while Stuart Armstrong becomes a really strong starter, then maybe that's enough to push them forward. But I have my doubts.
The ideal outcome of this for Vancouver is that Armstrong's presence allows Gauld to just be an attacker.
Yes.
That he doesn't have to worry about orchestrating at all, that he doesn't have to drop deep to get on the ball, that he and White can play off of each other. And so you never have either guy stranded. And Gauld, in those situations, is so good at floating outside or dropping into the half space to become like a sort of half space merchant, or even running off of White's shoulder and through the lines and getting into the box on the break. We haven't seen it yet. I hope it's in there. I think the West is already really interesting. The West with Vancouver as a legitimate threat moves up another level as a whole. Toronto have none of that. This was their best performance in ages. They went after it. I thought they played really well defensively, and through midfield, there was, I think, some stuff to be happy about, especially the performance of Alonso Coelho in central midfield. We haven't gotten to see much of him because of injuries, but he was very good. But it's just they're relying on Lorenzo Insigne, and DeAndre Kerr has finally won a starting job up top, and in a final on the road. I don't know what to say about Toronto anymore, man. Like, it's just like we're almost in October, and it's not clear what their best 11 is. It's not clear exactly how they want to play. It's not clear that they're really going anywhere, even though they're still in eighth place in the East.
So that's kind of my pushback here, is that, like, I think we don't know what to say now is because we've had this analysis, we've had these conversations in, like, March and then June, when I think we all thought this team was just going to suck, just straight up. Like, no deeper analysis now. Like, to a man, to a woman, they were picked 14th to 15th in the Eastern Conference. So I don't want to lose sight of the fact that this was supposed to be a transition.
That's still in reach.
So the fact that they got to the Canadian Championship Final, and again, look, there are three MLS teams in that competition, all three of them, the goal should be to win that every single year, right? Like, so, but they still got to the final, they had a good performance, and hey, man, on another day, maybe they win, right? Like, they're above the playoff line, and they're still playing meaningful games right now, which, if you told me this in February, I would have laughed at you and said, there's absolutely no chance, right? Like, not even in contention for the playoffs, let alone above the playoff line. They have played one more game than everybody below them, except for Chicago, who are 7 points below. I think we could end their season, right? But they played Chicago this weekend. Short rest, long travel, heartbreak of losing a final in the penalty shootout. It is pretty close to a must-win for them, because the teams trailing them below the playoff line, again, all have a game in hand, and again, they're not great teams, Montreal, Atlanta, but they are only 2 points behind. So, with Toronto playing at Chicago this weekend, home versus the Red Bulls, home versus Miami in the last two games, it's kind of a must-win here in this spot against Chicago. It's the easiest of the three opponents that you're going to face. And then they're off on decision day. They're the unlucky team that has the bye. Their last game is October 5th against Miami, and then they just have a brutal two-week wait. Did we do enough to make the playoffs or not? And we're going to train, and either our season's over or we're into the playing round. And if they get into the playoff round, it is a successful season.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
So just getting there, even though the final two-thirds of the year, they played at a sub-1-point-per-game pace.
Yeah.
And none of the young players have really developed.
The bar is very low. The bar is very low because this group, what they inherited was a cap situation from the outside, very obviously bad. I've been privy to some more inside information. It is worse than imaginable. Adama Diomande, Michael Bradley, Josie Altidore, I know this was the Revs, but like all of these people are still on the MLSPA salary dump from this year because of the bad contracts that they've signed, and most of them coming with Toronto. They pulled money forward, and this is what happens at clubs' desperate attempts to save your job. Who cares? It's somebody else's problem to deal with. This year, just the year elapsing was going to be good news for everybody at this team. And, like, again, that's a very, very low bar. I understand. But this year was always a transition year. And now, in the winter, I'm going to be much more critical of the transfers they make, what the plan is, right? Like,
are they going to make transfers in the winter? Because this team has not done much over the past 18 months.
Because they were hamstrung. Mostly hamstrung, and two, like, they could have had U-22s. I'm just going to say there was a club president in charge that I think ownership correctly decided, we're not giving you any more money because you're just going to waste it. There's a new regime. It's Jason Hernandez with the keys right now, right? Like, I think he's shown, at the bare minimum, competency. I think he's a good GM. Again, I think he inherited an awful situation. I do hope that there will be funds there, and it doesn't need to be a $15 million contract for Lorenzo Insigne, and hopefully it's not. But, like, again, a $3 to $5 million signing, whether it's a DP or a 21-year-old on the U22 initiative, I think would go a long way for this group. They made some really good signings. Davy Flores, Longstaff, I thought those were really good signings. Like, getting Richie Larea into this team, I thought that's good. I think that they have a foundations of something. They have a lot to do, but this year was about transition.
I agree with that last part. This year was obviously about transition. They have 8-10 points more than I expected them to have at this point. That is some measure of success. They obviously got to a final. They played well in the final. Obviously didn't hoist a trophy, but that's not nothing. Now they're playing for their lives. As you said, they're at Chicago this weekend, 8:30 p.m. on Saturday. Almost a must win, especially when you look at how close Montreal and
the mighty CF Montreal
and Nashville have gotten to that line, and how soft the remaining schedule for those two teams are, and those two teams that have a game in hand. And that's to say nothing of the Philadelphia Union, who are actually in ninth place on the same points as TFC, but have played one fewer game. So it's a lot. They need to, I mean, honestly, I think if they play this well, if they bottle this performance and they play this well in Chicago, that feels like a very gettable 3 points for TFC. And they need it. They need it. So we have three champions from last night. Congrats to Club America, their fifth title in the past 2 years. Congrats to LAFC, who broke their curse in finals with a 3-0 win, or 3-1 win, excuse me, over Sporting KC. And congrats to Vancouver, who have made it three Canadian championships on the trot. They will be in CONCACAF Champions Cup next year.
Don't draw Tigres. Please let them have a non-Tigres round one.
Give them a softie in round one for once, please. All right, let's move along to coaching search updates. You were busy tweeting out. We got to get you over on Blue Sky at some point. Tweeting out updates basically throughout the week. We'll start with Atlanta because that's the big one. Wow, really great scoop here, Tom. Patrick Vieira is a finalist. Nobody saw this coming. You're the only person in the world with the type of sources and connections who could have put out this tweet. Sources across the league assume this will happen, but Atlanta insists they're just getting to the final stage. I am going to ask this. Are they just getting to the final stage because they're not going to make a hire of the head coach until they have a GM technical director in place first? And is that GM technical director going to be Chris Henderson?
Yeah, these are nice questions after just a really nice opening by you there. I appreciate the respect for my work here. I think that these two things are going on concurrently. I'm assuming that Garth Lagerwey is just in meetings 16 hours a day doing interviews for all of these things. But it's not a situation where they're waiting to hire a GM, because if they were, they wouldn't have gotten this far in the coaching search. So Patrick Vieira is who I'm expecting ultimately ends up with this job. I think that would be an excellent hire. I think it would make a lot of sense for this particular manager and this particular club. If I'm going to keep speculating here, and again, I just want to be careful, this isn't sourcing this next part. Like, I'm assuming Chris Henderson would end up with Atlanta United just because of what's gone down in Miami, his contract situation, and the fact that Garth Lagerwey and Henderson worked together very, very well for a long time.
So let's clarify the Chris Henderson stuff, because he is still working for an Inter Miami team that still has two trophies on the mind. My understanding of his situation, his contract expired at the end of 2023 and he never signed a new one. So he's just kind of like, he's an at will employee.
Pro bono.
not exactly pro bono. I'm
love of the game.
At will employee for
it's
Inter
disrespectful,
Miami.
Man. It's disrespectful. This is one of the best GMs executives in the league. It's a joke, dude. It's a joke.
I wasn't expecting you to come with that much fire, but like, yes, he is clearly one of the best in the league. Miami have brought in executives over him. I forget the name of the guy, but a former Barcelona executive who now has some level of say in transfer.
He's the president. Like, he oversees all of that. He is Chris Henderson's boss, if we're doing an org chart here. and from talking to sources around when all this was happening, what I was told is that the plan was to bring in director of football as his technical title. That the plan was to bring in a director of football for the last few years. So it's not like Henderson and the staff were blindsided. But like their new director of football has come in and he said all the right, you know, hey, like, because he was at Real Zaragoza, also owned by the Mas family. You know, I know Chris, I've worked with Chris, I'm not here to replace him. Yeah, I'm here to work with him, all this stuff, right? That's what he said in his opening interviews. And then within his first days, he told, hey, Chris Henderson, your office? No, that's not my office. Pack your crap, move into another office. Maybe you could take Mark Prezant's office, who I just fired, and maybe you could take Nicky Budulic's office, who I just fired. So I think public versus private are two different things here. And the jokes kind of came with people around the sources around the league being like, dude, Garth's going to, like, it was an open secret. Bocanegra was not going to be at Atlanta United in 2025. It was whether it was going to happen during the season or in the offseason. And people are like, dude, like, are you kidding? Like, Garth's going to have the chance to bring Chris Henderson in. Like, are you kidding me? Like, that's kind of the way that it was viewed. And again, I know it's been a slower turnaround than fans have hoped for. It's been a slower turnaround than I've expected for Atlanta United. I'm still just benefit of the doubt to Garth Lagerwey in this group.
If it's Garth Lagerwey as club president, Chris Henderson as GM, and Patrick Vieira as head coach, and two open DP slots, and potentially three open U22 slots, and Arthur Blank with an open checkbook, you have to like Atlanta.
Yep.
I'm going to predict right now that Tom is going to write and Atlanta United won the offseason post, forgive me, sport, sometime around February 22nd.
I got no rebuttal.
I don't think that's, like, we can't even put money on that one. That is off the board. Another tweet. This one was a better tweet, Tom.
Thank you. Have
interviewed Bruce Arena, Greg Berhalter, our good friend Gio Savarese, and Robin Fraser, all candidates for the head coaching job at the very least. And Ian Russell, who is currently the interim manager, is also a candidate. You and I both agree that Greg Berhalter is much more likely to end up at Chicago. I frankly think that one is pretty close to done.
Yeah.
I put out my postmortem today on San Jose, and they have been like, we all understand that San Jose have been bad for a long time. They are worse than I think folks even realize, and it has not gotten better over the past 3 years as Chris Leach has first become chief soccer officer and second has had money to spend. Over the past 2 years, the Quakes have spent $10 million in the transfer market, more than $10 million in the transfer market. That is more than they spent in the previous 15 combined. So when you see names like Bruce Arena and Greg Berhalter and Gio Savarese, those three in particular, I don't think, oh, they're interviewing to go work for Chris Leach. I think they're interviewing maybe to take over the whole thing and rebuild it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any info on that. I think it's a fair question to be asked, or a fair deduction to kind of be reached, because when I was first reporting on this and somebody told me, like, Greg Berhalter interviewed with San Jose, I was like, dude, give me a break, bro. Like, no. Like, why would he do that, right? Like, and it was like, it happened. And apparently there were assurances that there would be a raise in spend. And I think that you can deduce that pretty fairly by Bruce Arena taking the interview. Bruce Arena isn't going to go somewhere where he's not going to be able to make many changes. Like, what he did in New England was got ownership to spend. And I think that's his lasting legacy with the New England Revolution, like, as much as the supporter shield that he won with that team. So I think that should be a positive sign. And again, like, we'll see. We'll see. A lot of teams make these promises. A lot of owners make these promises. It is much easier to say this in an interview when you're trying to land your top targets than it is, okay, write the check for $6 million so we can go sign another DP next to Hernan Lopez and Christian Espinosa.
No. Carlos Guerrero is still under contract for next year. He's on about $1.7 million. He has not played like a DP.
It's It's been
he has been really disappointing. The other disappointing thing, and I wrote about this in my postmortem, they haven't made the effort to play their academy products. And we've banged on it on this show. We've talked about it on This Is MLS. Kalen Carr, who has not traditionally been a play your kids guy, has been completely play your kids about San Jose. And you look at, you know, Fidel Barajas, developed by RSL, sold to Chivas for $4 million. Cade Cowell was sold to Chivas for $4 million over a year ago now, playing much better for Chivas than he ever did for San Jose. And was only sold to Chivas after they weren't able to get deals done across the line for clubs in both Italy and France with Cade Cowell. Diego Luna, he's probably going to end up second in the 22 under 22 balloting. He was a guy who was in the Quakes Academy for a hot minute there. Max Arston, starting for the best or second best team on the continent. He was a Quakes 2 guy. It goes down the list. You know, Oscar Verhoeven, as soon as it was obvious in April that the Quakes weren't winning anything this year, why was Oscar Verhoeven not getting minutes at right back? He's finally starting now. Edwin Mendoza, who started for the US U-20s at D-Mid, he has not gotten an MLS minute yet. Neither has Cruz Medina. And to be fair, Cruz Medina has really struggled over the past 18 months with Quakes 2. He hasn't been great, but at some point he's so talented, you figure out a way to get him out there. Cade Cowell, his younger brother Chance, who's like a Cade regen, he's 16, 17 years old. He hasn't made his MLS debut yet. And like Emi Ochoa, given how disastrous San Jose's goalkeeping has been all year long, even before Daniel got hurt, he was terrible to start the year. We're in an era in which young goalkeepers around the league are getting minutes in a way they never have before. Emi Ochoa, who's the number one for El Tri's CONCACAF Champions U-20 side, has yet to make his MLS debut. None of this makes sense. None of this indicates a culture in which kids are going to want to sign and stay and develop, because development, like the only one who's gotten minutes is Nico Chiquiris. And I don't think Nico Chiquiris took a step forward this year. It is everything that you expect to see from a team that's about to win their record fifth wooden spoon. And it's everything about it says it is ripe for an overhaul from the top down, the bottom up. Jeremy Abobasi said it. Like, we don't know who's going to be in the locker room next year. You can't talk about the future at this point. It's bad.
Look, they've made the playoffs three times in the last dozen years. They have not advanced in any of those three playoff trips.
Never hosted a playoff game at PayPal Park. They opened that in 2015.
It's crazy.
That thing is barely older than Kevin Sullivan. Or no, Kevin Sullivan is barely older. Anyway.
I think we got your point. Yeah, like it's really disappointing. And you know, in your column, like digging through those numbers, like starting to think of postmortems as well, like this team, yeah, like they could increase spend, but it's not just that. Like again, talk about the Philadelphia Union. They're not a beacon of spend, right? But like their club record signing is like 2.8 million. Hernan Lopez was 6. Christian Espinoza was 2. Like, can you make more signings in the 2 to 6 range that are better than this? Can you develop all the talent rich area? They have done better, but they're not like they could be maximizing this like the Philadelphia Union, like FC Dallas have, like NYCFC, like the Red Bulls, like RSL. They could be maximizing this, and they're just not. And again, people who know the youth soccer scene better than me, people who know the academy system, the ins and outs, the bureaucracy, the money, the investment, the all that, they do not say good things about the San Jose Earthquake in terms of infrastructure, in terms of spend, in terms of taking it seriously. What they do say is the talented kids in the academy. That's great. But there are players, again, Fidel Barajas, Diego Luna, like that can't happen. And the the counter arguments I would get from people, it's like, oh, well, you know, well, we had Cruz Adina, and Cruz was a better prospect than Diego Luna all throughout the time. Dude, it doesn't need to be an either or.
Signed
like
both.
That was what was really confusing to me. Emi Ochoa is like, this has been a historically bad goalkeeping season. When Daniel was injured for a long time, like, and I think that he's a good goalkeeper, and it makes sense why he's playing right now. But like, did we need to see 15 starts of William Yarbrough and then Jacobson? And I think that there was another goalkeeper in there along the way. All of them. There was a point at the end of summer, the five worst goalkeepers in terms of advanced metrics, four of them played for the Quakes. Why is Emi Ochoa not playing? Why is Casey Walls not playing? Like, why is Oscar Verhoeven not playing? Edmund Windosi, many of his players, like, what is the point in playing out the string under an interim coach? You have 18 points. You're not winning anyway. Jimmy Bobasi's got to go out here and say, like, dude, everything's a disaster. Like, why? What do we do? What is the point here?
Can you talk about the Play Your Kids? I guess you can call it a campaign if you want around MLS. They are at the forefront of it. Play Your Kids.
Oh, Play Your Kids
campaign. Play Your Kids campaign.
Okay. That's a real thing.
I don't know. Maybe it's more of a Twitter thing.
Oh, okay. I like it, though. Play Your Kids. Why not?
Come on, Lloyd. You got to be able to follow along.
Yeah, that's about it. I've gotten this team, man. We'll see what happens. I will say again, to end this on a positive note, I was pleasantly surprised that Bruce Arena, Greg Berhalter, Gio Savarese are taking interviews with this team. And like, that's, again, not a hard part to clear. But if we want to end on a positive, that's all I got.
Yeah, it does suggest, I don't know, it suggests something. I will say that, Hernan Lopez as a 10, Christian Espinoza still very good as a right winger. Jeremy Abobasi hasn't been great this year, but like 9 goals, 4 assists in about 2,000 minutes. That's not bad when everything around you is falling apart. That is a pretty decent structure to get guys like Cruz Medina and Chance Myers onto the field as attacking left wingers, to put Nico Chiquiris or Edwin Mendoza in a spot deeper in midfield where they could succeed. I just hope that becomes part of the Quakes' DNA going forward. There's so much talent in that area. We're seeing that talent have success for other clubs. There's not much more damning than that. Let's move on to something a little happier. Per your sources in North Texas, Peter Luxon, front runner to be named head coach of FC Dallas. I love this. I think he has done more than enough to earn the job, even if Dallas falls short of the playoffs, because he has been handcuffed with massive injuries since taking over for Nico Estevez. Well, he has got that team playing on a 55-point pace, even without Alan Velasco and Jesus Ferreira for most of it. They are 1.64 points per game under Peter Luxon, 0.88 under Nico Estevez. And just anecdotally, watching them, it's a night and day difference. They play with an attacking freedom. And, since Luxon is French, I'll say it, and a joie de vivre, that has not been seen in Dallas since maybe the 2016 team. I have really loved watching this team play the past 2 months.
You're so cultured, dude. It's unreal. It's so cool. So under Luxon, they have scored again. You were talking about, like, it's very easy, I think, when you watch this team now compared to earlier in the season. It's great. The numbers, just again, in terms of box score numbers, 2.2 goals a game under Luxon, 1.1 under Nico Estevez. Like, it's double. They've largely had the same players. Jesus Ferreira hasn't been available for really either coach. He's just kind of just getting back now. Alan Velasco is making his cameos off the bench. Like, it's a little late for him to make a big, big impact in this season after tearing his ACL. So it's not been like, oh, well, this player was injured and we didn't have a chance, right? Like, this is just, they're playing better with most of the same pieces. And it makes sense to me that Dallas would identify him and said, hey, you earned it. Like, talking to sources when he was named interim manager, it was like, hey, he has a real chance at this job. Like, we believe in him. We think he's a very good coach. And like, we're not talking about a coaching search yet. They're going through one, of course. But from what I was told is that he is absolutely the front runner. And my expectation is that he is going to be officially getting this job at some point in the offseason.
Just as someone who watches all this stuff every week, I certainly hope he gets the job. His teams have been a joy to watch. And the players talk about him in the post game. Like, it sounds like the crew players talking about Wilfred Nancy. Where it's just like, oh, we understand how lucky we are to play for someone who wants to play like this. Because most players, they go out there, they want to use the ball. They want to play aesthetically pleasing soccer. And that's what FC Dallas are right now. LA Galaxy are right now atop the Western Conference standings. We had thought that Greg Vanney was coaching for his job all season long. And it turns out he kind of was in terms of getting that contract renewed. In fact, auto-renewed by making the playoffs. So Greg Vanney is no longer potentially on the chopping block. Your reporting is that he is through 2025 now the head coach of the Galaxy by making the playoffs.
Yeah, sources confirmed that Corner of the Galaxy first reported that his deal auto-extended with triggering a clause of if they made the playoffs, he's guaranteed through 25. My assumption is that they're going to talk about a long-term contract in the offseason. They're obviously thrilled with how the season has gone, how the new pieces has fit and excelled under Greg Vanney this season, and it's just been an excellent season for the LA Galaxy. And again, no surprise that they will be talking about a long-term deal in the winter.
Do you have anything on St. Louis City FC? Because I have heard they're talking to some USL coaches potentially for the head coaching job, and that interim manager John Hackworth is still prominently involved and maybe even the favorite to get the full-time coaching job.
Yeah, for me, I've heard similar things about Hackworth. I'm told kind of everything's open right now. Hackworth is absolutely in the mix. He's somebody who has wanted a head coaching job. I think he's done fine, well, with this group right now. And maybe he's earned the look at a full season. We'll see. Again, nothing has been decided. And I'm not even comfortable necessarily saying front runner just yet. But he's definitely in the final stages.
I like the fact that USL coaches are being considered here potentially. Danny Cruz with Louisville City has done really excellent work. Eric Quill from New Mexico United. That team plays good soccer. And Eric Quill, of course, has the bona fides of a player development kind of guru. He was part of FC Dallas for a long, long time. We should mention the game is scheduled for this weekend. St. Louis, of course, have that barbecue against Sporting KC at 8:30 p.m. on Saturday. The Galaxy have a bye week. They will end the weekend, atop the Western Conference no matter what. They have a 7-point gap over second place RSL. San Jose doesn't matter. San Jose are playing at Montreal, 7:30 p.m. Dallas hosting
sickos.
Absolutely. Dallas hosting Orlando on Saturday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. That is a must win for Dallas. And then Atlanta United at Philadelphia, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. Kind of a do or die game for the Five Stripes. Well, maybe not quite there yet, but it's hard to see them getting into the playoffs if they don't pick up at least a point in this one and keep it tight. Our headline matches for the weekend, we already mentioned Cincinnati versus LAFC, 7:30 on Saturday, Philly, Atlanta, the barbecue, Vancouver versus Portland, Cascadia Cup, 10:30 p.m. Eastern. No Evander for that one. Sorry for yelling right there. My cat just bit my foot really hard. I hate you, Taquito. God, he's really all over me right
good
now. And the Hudson River Derby, 7:30 p.m. Let's talk about this one for a little bit. NYCFC, winless in 9. The Red Bulls, just 2 wins in 3 months now since Emil Forsberg left injured. Does this give this game a lot of juice or like no juice? Because like both teams should feel desperate. Both teams should feel like this is a chance to maybe prove something.
Yeah, I mean, neither team has won since July. It's disappointing what happened in like that second tier of the Eastern Conference playoffs. these two teams in Charlotte FC, and Charlotte FC got a big win last weekend, but like they've just, all three of these teams have fallen so far off the pace of that top three and have shown no signs of being able to compete in the playoffs against the top three. So that's where my head is at. Like, we're at the time of the season where everything is viewed through the lens of playoffs, whether it's seeding, whether it's the Shield, which again, we've already talked about, is over. And it's, hey, can this team challenge and actually make a run? Or is this just going to be a, hey, we made the playoffs again, round one and out? That's what both of these teams look like. The silver lining is they might play each other in the first round, so somebody has to advance. And a derby is a chance to get right. A derby is a chance to build momentum and say, you know, after the game, if there's a 2-0 win for either side, you're in the locker room, you're celebrating, everything's feeling good, and you say, hey, I don't care what happened since July. I don't care. Nothing matters. We're all looking forward. Today is the start of something new, and we're going to the playoffs, and nobody wants to play us. That's how you say it. You rally around each other, right? Like, this ends up as a boring 0-0 or 1-1 or somebody squeaks through on a set piece. You can try that. But like, this is a chance of a jumping off point for one of these two teams for a really good performance in a derby match and to say, no, we're going to finish fourth in the East and we're going to have home field advantage and we're going to get out of the first round. So that's kind of where I'm looking at it. But I don't have huge hopes.
There have been hopes, I guess, that Emil Forsberg would be able to play a role in this game. He didn't even make the bench last week for the Red Bulls. And again, he has not started a game since June 1st. He's played 4 minutes total since then. It's been very opaque in terms of his injury status and his timeline.
Yeah, and dude, I'm just going to take a second to beat my annoyance. The Red Bulls have been one of the worst in this league in terms of injury information. Kyle Duncan, what sounds to be a long-term knee injury, out, injured knee training surgery. That's it. Emil Forsberg, when he went out, lower leg injury. And I was like, when's he coming back? I don't know. Maybe by the, hey, if we make a run in the League's Cup, maybe he'll be there. Obviously, that's not. That would have been a month and change ago. Peter Shroud, we saw him break his ankle in a game. We're not doctors, but the way an ankle isn't supposed to move the way it did. The announcement is Peter Shroud ankle injury. That's it, right? Like, this is very frustrating that we don't have information. And all we can do is speculate. And all we can do is be frustrated at, when is Emil Forsberg coming back? Sandro Suarez said, I think a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, that they were expecting him to be back for this game against NYCFC. I believe he'll have his pregame press conference at some point today, if not tomorrow. And hopefully we'll get an update then. So hopefully we see Emil Forsberg this weekend, but we just don't know because they don't give any information.
And the Red Bulls have no chance without Emil Forsberg.
Straight up none. We've got
more than half a season worth of data on that. Two wins out of, I think, 18 now without Emil Forsberg. They're not losing a lot of games, but they do not have the ability, the final third quality, to put teams away. This seems like a chance at a get right game for NYCFC. I've said even throughout this winless skid, I still like their talent. Alexandre Rodriguez a lot. Alonso Martinez has been one of the most pleasant surprises this year. Hannes Wolf is really good. I love both Julian Fernandez and Agustino Heda, and I find it bizarre that they have played, I mean, combined maybe 250 minutes over the past 2.5 months. We've talked about coaches on the hot seat. Nick Cushing's got to be feeling it, man, because he's been there 2.5 years now. He has got a lot of $5 to $8 million players coming through that CFG pipeline, and they haven't looked it. They mostly have not looked the part. So it could be do or die time for NYCFC. For the Red Bulls, there's always less urgency because that's just how they're run. I'm looking forward to this Hudson River Derby anyway. It'll be a good one. Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. Eastern on MLS Season Pass. Tom, plug your work for us. And first of all, thank you for coming in and filling in for Weeby, who is off being a celebrity in Charlotte. plug your work for us. Soccer-wise, HQ, what, 3 days a week?
Yeah, I'm on two shows a week. David Goss does one with Jordan Angeli on NWSL and U.S. Women's National Team. And then he does, right now, one by himself, and he's thinking about doing a second. So we got a bunch of shows every week. If you're a soccer fan in this country, there is something for you. I promise you that. And then check out the written content at Give Me Sport. And CBS Catch Me on TV did some stuff with Goal USA this week as well. So just a busy man. I'm using my short-term call-ups everywhere. I get four pretty much everywhere. So I hope that maybe there's going to be a rule change before the end of the season and I can get called up here again. If not, I'll see you in preseason.
love it. Tom, thanks a bunch for filling in, my friend. We got a full slate of games this weekend on MLS Season Pass. You know how to tune in, where to tune in for all that. And we will see you again on Monday. We'll be right back.